everybody wants to be famous now. Everybody can be famous now. And more than that, everybody thinks fame is going to fix them. It's not just because they want to be a whatever an influencer is. It's because once you are that, you have eyes on you. And that is what people crave. And they will spend their lives chasing that dream. And having met a few famous people in my day, I can tell you it doesn't really work like that.
This is Shelf Life. In this episode, I talk to Jerry Stoll, the acclaimed screenwriter for shows like Moonlighting and author of the best-selling memoir, Permanent Midnight, later made into a movie. Now he's back with a travelogue of sorts in which he describes a bus tour of Nazi death camps that is simultaneously funny and profound. Find out what connects that trip with one of his favorite books, Nathaniel West's The Day of the Locust, after this.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The Pentagon has readied 1,500 active-duty soldiers for possible deployment to Minnesota. A U.S. official confirmed this to NPR, speaking on the condition of anonymity, as they were not authorized to speak publicly. The move comes as Minnesota Governor Tim Walz mobilized the state's National Guard yesterday to help local law enforcement in case they're needed. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports.
That official tells NPR that the troops will be coming from Alaska, where they specialize in cold weather operations. It's very cold in Minneapolis right now. Those troops have been placed on prepare to deploy orders in case the situation here escalates. NPR reached out to the Pentagon to confirm. Chief Pentagon spokesman Sean Parnell said, quote, "The Department of War is always prepared to execute the orders of the commander-in-chief if called upon." President Trump threatened to invoke the Insurrection Act last week. But the situation on the ground has been relatively quiet the past few days, and local leaders have urged calm. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Minneapolis.
President Trump says he'll impose tariffs on 8 European nations until there's an agreement for the U.S. to buy Greenland from Denmark. Today, all 8 nations issued a statement that they stand in full solidarity with the Kingdom of Denmark and the people of Greenland. A U.S. congressional delegation visited Copenhagen this weekend to try to reassure Denmark. NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports.
They met with the Danish prime minister, top officials from Greenland and Denmark, and they also spoke with Danish business leaders, because just like there's foreign policy implications here, there's also economic ones as well. I spoke with New Hampshire Senator Jean Shaheen, a Democrat. She pointed to a long history of relations between the two countries. Danish soldiers fought and died alongside Americans in Afghanistan, for example, and she expressed the deep concern that the people of Greenland and Denmark feel.
NPR's Barbara Sprunt reporting from Copenhagen. Israel is raising objections to President Trump's new leadership board for Gaza. It's rare public disagreement by Israel to Trump's peace plan for Gaza. NPR's Daniel Estrin reports from Tel Aviv.
President Trump late Friday announced a new Gaza executive board that will oversee governance in Gaza, replacing Hamas. Israel is objecting to 2 members of the oversight board, the foreign minister of Turkey and a senior official from Qatar. That's because Israel sees Qatar and Turkey as primary backers of Hamas. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he's asking the matter be raised with Secretary of State Marco Rubio. But analysts in Israel say Netanyahu knows there's not much Israel can do about it. Qatar and Turkey are Trump's close allies, and Trump said in a social media post that those countries would help demilitarize Hamas. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
And you're listening to NPR News in Washington. Local officials in Russian-occupied parts of southern Ukraine say more than 200,000 homes and businesses are without power after a Ukrainian drone strike yesterday. Temperatures are well below freezing throughout the region. Russia has frequently targeted Ukraine's energy grid during the nearly 4-year war. Ukrainian officials say at least one person was killed in a Russian attack overnight. Officials in Guatemala said today that hundreds of anti-riot police entered a maximum security prison and freed guards who had been taken hostage by prisoners. No injuries or deaths were immediately reported. Dozens of guards are still being held at 2 other prisons, apparently part of a coordinated inmate uprising. At the Australian Open tennis tournament, Venus Williams has been eliminated in her first round match. Lindsay Arkley has more on the story.
45-year-old Williams accepted a wildcard entry into the Australian Open, returning to the tournament after 5 years as the oldest player ever in the singles main draw. Her first round match was against Olga Danilovic of Serbia, ranked 69th in the world and more than two decades younger. Williams took the first set 7-6, but Danilovic fought back, taking the second set 6-3 and the decider 6-4. Williams, who returned to tennis last season after a 16-month break, is still in the doubles draw at the Australian Open, paired with Ekaterina Alexandrova of Russia. For NPR News, I'm Lindsay Arkley in Melbourne.
And I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Legacy Box, dedicated to preserving family memories, old tapes, films, and photos, with the goal of spreading joy of reliving the moments that matter in the new year. More at legacybox.com.
Everybody wants to be famous now. Everybody can be famous now. And more than that, everybody thinks fame is going to fix them. It's not just because they want to be a whatever an influencer is. It's because once you are that, you have eyes on you. And that is what people crave. And they will spend their lives chasing that dream. And having met a few famous people in my day, I can tell you it doesn't really work like that.
Hello and welcome to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin. A warning. This conversation contains references to suicide, addiction, and genocide. On this episode of Shelf Life, we take a bus trip to Auschwitz in the company of the writer, Jerry Stahl, who in 2016 set off for Poland to confront one of the darkest chapters in human history. If that has you reaching for the off button, not so fast. The resulting book, 999, not the number 9, but the German word for no, is fast-paced, darkly absurd, and mordantly funny, without ever minimizing the horrors at its center. In that regard, it has something in common with Stahl's best-selling memoir, Permanent Midnight, about his years writing for TV shows like Alf and Moonlighting, while feeding a brutal heroin habit. Stahl went on to write for Twin Peaks, CSI, and comedian Marc Maron. Permanent Midnight was later made into a movie starring Ben Stiller. Jerry Stahl's book choice is a classic satire of the entertainment business, Nathaniel West's Day of the Locust. Jerry, welcome to Shelf Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
Black humor doesn't come much darker than a bus tour of Nazi death camps. I wonder if we can start with the context of this trip. It was undertaken as an assignment initially for Vice magazine.
Yes. Well, it wasn't just about the Holocaust per se. It was about I was very depressed and wanted to go somewhere where utter depression and complete soul-crushing despair was appropriate. So where better than the camps? But like most things in my life, it didn't succeed the way I thought, and it didn't the way I thought. It was a third way that I had not anticipated. So you arrive at Auschwitz, you're prepared, your soul is open, you want that big moment. You've been traveling across the globe for this, and you step inside and you're ready and you're on the bones of this revered and holy landscape. And the first thing you see is some mook in an I'm with stupid t-shirt hammering pizza and Fanta down in the Auschwitz snack bar. And no one prepared me for that. I was ready for the 6 million. I wasn't prepared for pizza.
You find that the cafeteria in Auschwitz serves pork, which somehow I found more upsetting than almost anything else.
Not even a cafeteria, my friend. It is an outdoor cafe where you walk in, order your calzone, and then pop back out and sit in the outdoor chairs and tables, unlike Buchenwald, which had a lovely indoor cafe.
I think that's the one at the time when you're so mad that you walk into a plate glass window and then have to go to the bathroom to suture your wounds.
One of my finer moments, I was so judgmental and superior. I just mad dogged them all walking by, like, how can you eat? And then, of course, plowed face first into a plate glass window, whereupon I had to go into the Buchenwald men's room to get Buchenwald paper towels for my Buchenwald forehead wound as I was bleeding copiously. So that was great. And then I had to sort of skulk by all these smirking, or so I imagined, diners.
I mean, you talk about being judgmental, but I thought one of the graceful aspects of your book was the fact that you start this journey with a group of American tourists that you feel at best ambivalent about.
Not just American, an international, some Australian, New Zealanders, Canadians, mostly, let's just say, English speaking.
But by the end of this trip, you have come to a kind of appreciation of many of your fellow passengers. Tell me about that other journey, the journey of coming to admire and like some of the people you're traveling with.
Well, I appreciate that you picked up on that. I don't have many rules of journalism, but the one that I tend to adhere to over the years is always make yourself the biggest idiot. That way, you can sort of come out looking like, look, I'm not superior to anyone. And by the end, you kind of find out that all your secrets are the same, all your insecurities are the same. I think at the end of the day, if there is a lesson in that regard, it's we're all scared, terrified, and uncomfortable. Some people just hide it better. So I grew to love them, including the octogenarian, Trump-loving Jewish fellow who I semi-bonded with.
It's interesting that you mention him. I think his name was Shlomo. We are talking a day after Mike Pence, of all people, criticized Donald Trump, a former president of the United States, hoping to be a future president of the United States, for dining with two prominent anti-Semites, Kanye West and a Holocaust denier, Nick Fuentes. It's the same week that I've seen a piece by the English-Czech playwright Tom Stoppard in the New York Times saying that he thinks the virus of anti-Semitism has been reactivated. Under all those circumstances, what might have seemed like a random tour of the Holocaust, where you could be friends with a Trump-supporting Jew, takes on a wholly new significance, doesn't it?
Yeah, and the sad fact is, I thought I was visiting the past, and in retrospect, much to my own horror, it turned out I was visiting the future.
You quote your grandfather in 999 saying, if you ever forget you're a Jew, a Gentile will remind you. Is that where we are right now, being reminded?
Absolutely. And it's reached that point where other ethnicities and quote unquote minorities and oppressed peoples have been for years, which is you got to watch your back and you got to watch who you're letting know, because I occasionally can pass. The older I get, the more of the map of the Negev blossoms on my forehead. But you do hear people, mixed company here and there, a gym locker room, you know, telling the odd Jew joke or just ragging on the Jews. And it's never just Jews, it's the Jews. That's generally the tell.
In Warsaw, you go to a market square. And among the souvenirs and trinkets that you discover is a popular item, a little wooden Jew made from linden trees with hand-painted beards and money bags. They come with an actual coin held in their hands. And the local saying is something like a Jew in the hallway means a coin in the pocket. But you nevertheless stock up on these wooden Jews as gifts for what, who? Friends, family? Who did you give them to?
Well, I guess you could say they're the ultimate stocking stuffer. Really. I gave them to friends, you know, family. I bought about a dozen. I have two left, or I'd send you one, but I'm hanging on to these for dear life. Sadly, they have not resulted in riches coming my way. Maybe that's because I'm not keeping them in the hallway. That could be my mistake. But they're very attractive. They're about 6 inches high, maybe a little smaller than your average sex toy in length and girth. And they're painted beautifully with a beard. And they're sort of rabbinical fellows holding a little coin. So you can actually see the Zloty, which, needless to say, as mentioned in the book, is the Burt Young of international currency. Not worth that much. But nevertheless, it's in the hot little hands of the little wooden rabbis. Did you know about it's like a lawn jockey, except that lawn jockeys are no longer sold in America, whereas I had no problem stocking up on little Jews. Actually, fun fact, there are now more wooden Jews in Poland than there are Jew Jews. So that's how that shook down.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to change anytime soon, for better or worse. I have never been to visit Auschwitz, though I have been to Yad Vashem, the Museum of the Holocaust in Jerusalem, on several occasions and found it genuinely devastating. What was it that affected you most at Auschwitz or Dachau? What were the things that made you stop in your tracks?
More than anything, because conceptually, we've all seen the pictures, we're pre-prepared for the stacks of bodies. Horrific, but we may be numb. But for me, it was the simple, inescapable, kind of an erectable ball of hair. They have like a 2-ton ball of hair behind a pane of glass. But along with the eyeglasses and shoes, little baby shoes, there's something so mundane. And I think, as often in life, it's the most mundane detail that just is the most searing. So that, for me, more than any lecture, more than any photograph, really brought it home in a way that killed me. No pun intended. That and the room, there is a torture room at Auschwitz in building 10, block 10, which is the torture area, where you can't stand up and you can't lie down. Mm. And they would put people in there and starve them. And that was devastating. The physicality of it, I guess, is what I'm saying in both these cases.
Does that make the case for keeping these places open for the public? Because one of the questions that hovers over this for me is, should anyone even be allowed to visit these places, let alone eat pizza and drink sodas there? Did you come to a view about the value of having these sites open to everyone?
I have my own opinion, and no one is consulting me. But yeah, given the amount of selfies and the fact that they have to put up a no Pokemon sign, I had my own selfie experience, which we can talk about. But yeah, I had the sense they should just surround it with a fence and people can drive by and look at it from afar. It's important to remember, this isn't just a concentration camp. This is a museum. But unlike most museums, I think there is a reverence due that it just isn't happening. And for my two cents, you can't enforce an attitude. But I think perhaps fencing it off and having people drive around on a ring road and look at it and feel it might, for my two cents, be a more effective way to go. Because there is no way to make it through that tour and the rooms and the sort of incidentals of mass death without feeling you're in some way diminishing their import, at least for me.
I'm Aaron Hicklin. You're listening to Shelf Life, and my guest today is the author, Jerry Stahl. We're talking about his new book, 999, a story about a bus trip he undertook to the death camps of Poland and Germany. Jerry, you mentioned there a selfie in Auschwitz. This is when you were mistaken for Kramer from Seinfeld. Tell me a little about that.
Yes, this one grotesque and unfortunate incident kind of consolidated my conflict with the whole thing, which is, in a nutshell, these charming young women, I'm going to go out on the limb and say, I think they were Filipinas, I'm not sure. They thought I was Kramer. Which, you know, number one is horrifying enough. Number two, ultra horrifying, is the fact that I'm sitting at Auschwitz obsessing on the fact that I look like Michael Richard, and then obsessing on the fact that I'm thinking about that at a death camp. Number three, not knowing the etiquette involved, I said, okay, so what is the etiquette when you're having a selfie taken at a death camp for a celebrity when you're not that celebrity? So long story short, I posed with the festive young women who were no doubt massively disappointed when they got home and realized I was a fraud, and then had to look over and see the other members of my camp just looking at me like, what the hell is wrong with this guy? You know, he's pretending to be Kramer and posing with teenage girls on the other side of the yard over here. So yeah, that happened, and it was weirdly devastating.
You quote Mel Brooks in this book. Tragedy is when I cut my finger. Comedy is when you fall into an open sewer and die. Is that partly what recommends humor to you as a way to process horror of this scale? Or is something else going on here?
I think that's a two-part question. But in my niggling defense, I will just say the subject of the humor was never on any level at any moment for even a second of the Holocaust. The humor I had, because I hadn't anticipated even writing a quote-unquote funny book, was all the rest of it. All the you-can't-make-it-up grotesquerie that came along with it. The third-generation crapper hand at Auschwitz, who literally wouldn't have a job if it weren't for the Holocaust, handing out toilet paper for a couple of zlotys. It's just all the garnish, you might say, of life that surrounds this museum of death. That's where the unexpected and wholly unanticipated humor came from.
You've written a lot of books, as I said, but I think it's fair to say that the most famous, in part because it was made into, frankly, a brilliant movie starring Ben Stiller, is Permanent Midnight. Basically, your story of earning $5,000 a week writing shows like Moonlighting and Alf while spending somewhere north of that every week on heroin and cocaine. Next year, you'll be 70. Anyone who's read Permanent Midnight or seen the movie might be surprised you're still with us. Does it surprise you?
Yeah, it's terrible for my cred. You know, there's nothing worse for an ex-dope fiend, semi-celebrity junkie than not dying young. You know, it literally, it's killing me. But what can you do? You know, here we are. And the thing that happened with Permanent Midnight, you know, I didn't write that movie, for the record. You know, I was a different kind of jerk in real life than I was in the movie, put it that way. But I end up looking like a yuppie gone bad because the publisher did not want the details of kind of living on the street, you know, operating out of my car and all the rest of it. And thank you for reminding me that I will be 70, because it's pretty shameful. I mean, I've done some shameful, egregious things in my life, but getting this old has to be at the top of the heap.
I'm hoping that you're jesting, because we're obviously thrilled that you're still with us. But there is an undertone in 999 of almost disappointment that you're still going.
Well, there's a section in 999 where I talk about, you know, I had hepatitis C for years. So for years, all these doctors were telling me I had a year to live, which, you know, badge of honor. It makes a trip to the 7-Eleven, an adventure and defiance, existential shenanigans. But the fact is, then I got cured of the hep C, and like, now what? So part of the book is also about that, confronting not just death, but life.
I mean, this reminds me of many people I've spoken to who were HIV positive and survived and didn't expect to, and essentially found they had a new lease of life, but also felt in a bizarre way slightly bereft of the struggle.
Did these people have survivor's guilt? Would you call it survivor's guilt?
For sure. I think much like many Jews who survived the Holocaust. Is that what you have?
Yeah. The people I was out there doing what I was doing with, many of whom died, some of whom in the very room I was in. But there is no statute of limitations for bodies in dumpsters, so we'll leave that. But there's tremendous survivor's guilt, and you have to wonder why, you know. So what can you do but write books?
Is that how you deal with it? Is that a way to sort of cauterize the guilt and the trauma?
perhaps not consciously, but in effect, there is no doubt that that is what I do, and that's how I survive. But I don't think that's unique to me. I think that is, pardon the expression, epigenetic. You know, I think it is in our genes, as it is in many an oppressed people, be they Irish or African American or at different times Italian or God knows what. You know, you survive by, as the great writer Stanley Elkin said somewhere, making carnival with your pain.
I wonder if you could conjure the young Jerry Stahl growing up in Pittsburgh. How would you characterize your childhood there? Was your family a part of the Pittsburgh Jewish community?
I grew up in a neighborhood that really didn't have any Jews. It was mostly Catholics, kind of a working class neighborhood. I was one of maybe two Jews in a school of 800. So I was perpetually being accused of killing Jesus, which I clearly must have done in a blackout at the age of five, since I had no memory. So, I would not say I was a big part of the Jewish community. I had relatives who lived in the Jewish part of town. We absolutely not. We lived in the Jew-killing part of town.
Your father made it out of Lithuania at the age of 10. His father was killed in a pogrom, and his mother, your grandmother, widowed. What do you think that trauma did to your father? He was nominated by Lyndon Johnson to be a circuit judge of the United States Third Circuit Court of Appeals, but died young, found in his car with the engine running.
I think what had to be brutal for him is that the man that my grandmother married was willing to pay for her to come over. So she had to literally abandon my father when he was two and work in this fellow's grocery store for 8 long years. And then when she had the money, send for my father, who came over by himself on a boat and would never talk about it. All he would say about those 8 years is that we were the only family that didn't have a cow. That was who he stayed with. That, and he would never eat stewed tomatoes because that's what they served in steerage on the boat. And that's all he ever said. And being a callow 16-year-old, by the time he checked out, I never really got to talk to him about it. But yeah, he took himself out at 49. Yeah.
That feels like a very raw regret that you didn't get to speak to him about his story.
One of many. Because even though he achieved success and more or less attained his dream at a fairly young age, you know, a lifelong appointment on the judiciary, it wasn't enough. And much like Primo Levi, you know, these people survive and then take themselves out later. And that is the eternal mystery.
When you talk about survivor's guilt, I wonder if you also feel in some ways that that is related to your father's experience and not having had that kind of traumatic background.
Absolutely. There is a part of me even growing up that felt guilty that he had to go through all he went through. Mind you, as a child, I think that this is more of an inchoate sense rather than something articulated, but I absolutely did. And then once he was gone, you can't help but feel in some way that you're responsible, or at least partly responsible, which is a job for the shrinks, and I won't impose on you, but I think is a not uncommon phenomenon among survivors of people who take their own life.
One consequence of your father's early death is that it tipped your mother into a full-on depression. She had electroshock therapy, which you describe in Permanent Midnight. In that sense, she was also a casualty of what your father had experienced in his trauma.
Well, to be fair and accurate, the electroshock was while he was still alive. My mother, you know, struggled with depression. And I believe she was diagnosed as unipolar, amazingly, which means that unlike the thrill that bipolar people have of being up and wildly creative, I think she was pretty much down for the count, if I remember correctly. So yeah, but you know, I have to say, people have survived far worse than my paltry difficulties. That just happened to be the circumstances of my life, and I don't in any way want to come off like, you know, poor me.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today is the author and screenwriter Jerry Stahl, whose new book is 999, an account of his tour of death camps in Europe. Jerry Stahl, you've said, I became a writer because I didn't want to leave the house. I'm not a leader of men. I'm the guy who just wants to write so the book can go out and have a life of its own and just do the talking for me. That suggests a pretty shy and introverted person. Is that how you would describe yourself?
Well, being a bit of a mood swinger, there is much of my time on the planet when I am something south of vivacious, for sure. Yeah. And writing is one of those things that if you have no skills, you know, I was a terrible musician. I didn't have the charisma to be an actor. I certainly couldn't hang out in an office. Definitely don't have the stamina to work in a factory. I mean, I've failed at all kinds of jobs. So, you know, writing was that thing you could do without leaving the house, you know, naked and effed up at 3 a.m. And, you know, it's very free on the page. But what happens is you say things or put them down on paper or on your computer at 3 a.m. You don't anticipate being, say, oh, I don't know, on a podcast some years later, having to talk about them, if not straight up justify them. It's like, oh, my God, what was I thinking when I wrote that? But as the great Bruce J. Friedman, yet another writer who I massively admire, Jewish American playwright, screenwriter, novelist said, if you write a sentence that makes you squirm, keep going. And needless to say, I've squirmed through many a book and none more than the one we are discussing right now.
You won a Pushcart Prize at the age of 21. That's a very young age to win such a distinguished prize. What did you win it for?
I won it for a story that was turned down by Hustler. Thanks for asking. It was called Return of the General. It was about a guy whose genitalia looked like George Washington and basically morphed into George Washington. This is so long ago, you weren't even born, but it was sort of a bicentennial tie-in type thing. So yeah, that's what that was about. And the good people in Pushcart Land saw fit to grace me with a gift.
So you're a young man when you write a story about a penis turning into George Washington. A few years later, you're writing for TV, ALF, 30-something, moonlighting, etc. Do you see yourself really as a book writer who took a detour through TV writing or as a TV guy who likes to write journalism and fiction?
I was basically a journalist who ended up in Hollywood, in Los Angeles, through a circuitous route. I slept my way to the middle. I married a British woman who needed a green card, who happened to know somebody who was doing a TV show that turned out to be ALF. So my tombstone will read, he only wrote one ALF. And I guess I would just say for the kids, you know, fail in all genres.
And just to remind everybody what ALF was about, but it's a creature from space.
It became a large part of my questionable legend because in the movie, it was featured prominently, whereas in real life, it was maybe a 0.1% of my existence. But, oh well, we can't control fate.
The chef, Anthony Bourdain, was a good friend of yours. He once said he'd like you to write his memoir. How well did you know him?
I knew him well enough that I was perpetually surprised when you would email him and he would get back to you 5 minutes later from the bowels of Uruguay. We knew each other from New York City a little bit. You know, Henry Miller has this great definition of friendship, which is like, you know, your best friend or, you know, a friend is someone you can see every 10 years. And when you see them, you can't stop talking. And I would say that was the kind of friendship that Bourdain and I had. We didn't hang. I wasn't in that world. But when we did see each other, we couldn't shut up. I did No Reservations a couple of times, Roscoe's House of Chicken and Waffles. And, well, I guess we all saw what we want to see in him by the end. But I thought he had the biggest heart of just about anyone I ever met. And who doesn't have demons? People are always fighting a war that you can't see. Somebody much smarter than me said that, and I'm probably butchering it. But I think that is true. And there is no better demonstration than Bourdain.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today is the author and screenwriter, Jerry Stahl. His latest book is 999. We'll be back after this to talk about Nathaniel West's The Day of the Locust.
It's been snowing in Pennsylvania and New York, and it's been snowing in Britain and Ireland too. So, as the Wackaloda Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, on Radio Catskill returns with a run of much more music editions of the show, I bring you songs about snow. I hope you'll join me on Sunday afternoon at 3.
So here's the deal. Public radio is now operating without federal funding, and your support matters more than ever. One way to help is to donate that car, truck, or old motorcycle in your driveway. You clear out some space and help keep trusted news coverage alive in your community. The process? Simple, free, even tax deductible. Just head to this station's website and help us keep this work going together.
Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at wjffradio.org.
You're listening to Shelf Life. I'm Aaron Hicklin, and my guest today is the author, Jerry Stahl. We're talking about one of his favorite books, Nathaniel West's The Day of the Locust. Jerry, Nathaniel West's fourth and longest novel, The Day of the Locust, is often described as the best novel about Hollywood ever written. It's decidedly not glamorous. It's filled with drifters and grifters, washed-up vaudeville stars, untalented wannabe actors, prostitutes. The center of this melange of people is Todd Hackett, an artist who is really there as a kind of cipher for the action that happens around him. And part of that action is dominated by two people, most notably Homer Simpson, later the inspiration, I think, for a more famous Homer Simpson these days, and Faye Greener, a 17-year-old platinum blonde would-be actress who sees men as playthings, but around whom they cannot but cluster like moths to a flame. Jerry, you said that Nathaniel West made you want to be a writer. What is it about this book that you admire so much?
Oddly enough, what I admire about this book is something I didn't realize until rereading it, which is, forget the Hollywood relevance. What West describes in Todd Hackett's obsession with this giant mural, the burning of Los Angeles, are these enraged masses who are angry in a way they don't even understand themselves. They don't know what they're angry about. They know they feel cheated. They feel gypped. They're angry at everybody who has anything. They don't worship movie stars. They loathe movie stars, and they want to tear them apart and the quote-unquote celebrity culture. And to me, what West was doing, though he doubtless could not have known at the time, he was describing MAGA. Mm-hmm. He was describing the MAGA movement and the wave upon waves of American citizens who themselves feel cheated and who don't want anything so much as they just want to get back at all the people who they feel Donald Trump is getting back at, you know, being completely suckered to the fact that he themselves is one of them. That made me love the book on a whole new level, because I'd never seen that so artfully described before.
Yeah, you're referring in particular to a kind of apocalyptic denouement or ending of this novel, which gets its title from the Bible for very obvious reasons when you get there. That's a scene that really comes like the wind, like a storm out of nowhere. I don't want to give it away too much for readers, but one of the characters that seems relatively mild-mannered, let's say, really becomes the tipping point for something extremely violent. You see that as a metaphor for where America is today.
I see the volatile and, you know, rage-filled citizenry going after the quote-unquote elites in the same way. And I think really that we are living in a slow motion apocalypse. a sort of slowed down version of what West was describing in that one scene on Hollywood Boulevard. And I think that is what Trump has tapped into. And that is what we are witnessing in the form of all the, you know, MAGA-ettes. To me, that's what Day of the Locust, almost accidentally and incidentally, if you read it now, it's hard to escape, at least for me, that that's really the subject of the book, even though he's describing something that didn't exist. But the movement and the energy and the hate and the anger is absolutely drawn and quartered and captured in a way that I've just never seen before.
The flip side of all this is that there are all these characters who still fervently believe in what we might call the American dream. They're coming to California because it somehow symbolizes something that is full of possibility and hope and optimism. It's all about pretense and surfaces and illusion, because none of these people have made it. They're all part of a sideshow. It's a very cynical view of America and LA and Hollywood in particular, which still has that hold on the imagination 90 odd years later after this book was published.
Is it cynical though, or is it realistic, and not just about Hollywood, but about America? Because everybody wants to be famous now. Everybody can be famous now. And more than that, everybody thinks fame is going to fix them.
Mm.
It's not just because they want to be a whatever an influencer is. It's because once you are that, you have eyes on you. And that is what people crave. They think fame will supply this life-changing soul balm that they didn't have without it. And they will spend their lives chasing that dream. And having met a few famous people in my day, I can tell you it doesn't really work like that.
The character at the heart of this novel, who is most obviously chasing fame, is an actress, Faye Greener. She's part of a love triangle between Todd Hackett, the artist, who is essentially the protagonist of the novel, and Homer Simpson, the older retiree. It's a very unequal love triangle. The two men love her. She doesn't love either of them, or really anyone. Did you feel any sympathy for Faye Greener, or was she pure monster?
I don't think she was a monster at all. I think she was purely human. You know, we're all damaged goods. Well, I'll speak for myself. But, you know, she was damaged. Her father was this failed vaudeville guy dragging her around from house to house as he's trying to sell silver polish. And, you know, she was an extra and an extra in a scene that got cut out of some sword and sandal epic. And that still goes on. But it's no longer, I would argue, restricted to Hollywood. It's now worldwide, or more importantly, web-wide, and everybody is going for that. And she would probably be on YouTube today if she were around with her own channel.
I don't know if you've ever seen the book by Weegee, the famous street photographer, called Naked Hollywood.
Yes, of course.
It's an incredible book. He's best known for 1930s images of New York, but Naked Hollywood gives the same treatment to Hollywood. These grotesque, kind of black and white images of people he photographed in Los Angeles, actors, prostitutes, hustlers. I felt The Day of the Locust was the sort of text equivalent of Ouija's Naked Hollywood. I just felt like I was entering those images as I read this. All the characters in Nathaniel West's novel are in those photos. A kind of circus freak show, really.
But the freaks are the norm. And there's a grand tradition of that in American literature. I mean, Flannery O'Connor does it with the Southern grotesques. And I remember she was interviewed, you know, why do you think a Catholic writer such as yourself writes so much about the grotesque? And she said, because we can still recognize it, you know? And I think the point there is grotesquery is us at this point. And it's what gets you in the door now, being a human being. We live in very twisted times. It's hard to find anyone in a Nathaniel West book, any of them, written at any time I mean, I remember the first book of his I read, The Dream Life of Baldo Snell, which is a rather obscure book. It was his first book. It all takes place with like a Trojan horse or something. Don't ask me to explain, but I read it when I was 15. And for no apparent reason, he has this tossed off line written while sniffing the forefinger of my left hand. And I don't know what that means, but I do know as a 15-year-old, I was like, oh my God, I don't even know you're allowed to write this stuff. So he's always been a huge influence, all the way back to Miss Lonely Hearts. You know, I think would start something like, Dear Miss Lonely Hearts, I was born without a nose. You know, it's so dark, but to me, that's what makes it so human.
There's a whole chapter in this book dedicated to a vicious cockfight in which one of the birds is ultimately killed. I found it unbearable to read, I have to say. What do you think West is trying to tell us in that scene? In some ways, I couldn't help finding a parallel to the death camps that you write about, just in terms of the sense of a collapse of a certain moral value system that fight seems to represent. And also, as a prelude to the final apocalyptic chapter of this book.
You know, having written and been written about by critics myself, I'm loath to sort of, you know, attribute intent to what an author might have been doing. But it certainly operates on that level. That is an absolutely legitimate interpretation. But I covered one myself many years ago. Don't ask me why or where, but it is a real thing. And it is as brutal as it gets. But what is really brutal, and this is what West captures, are the expressions on the faces of the people attending. That's where you really see humanity at its purest.
Do you have a favorite character in this book?
It's a tough call, you know. I love Homer because he has this odd tick where he never knows what to do with his hands. So he will get up periodically and go to the sink and run water and put his hands down there, and they're described as looking like sort of nervous sea creatures who can never find a position where they're not uncomfortable. And for some strange reason, I found that totally relatable. But, you know, it's also hard not to love Abe Cusich, the little person, the feisty little guy, and Todd Hackett himself, who is a complete outsider. You describe him as a cipher, but he's also the eyes and ears of the novel, and it is he whose vision we finally see when he's swept up in the apocalyptic ending, and we won't give that away. But they're all supremely, unlikably lovable to me.
I do love that way that West describes Homer Simpson's hands, because the hands, you say it's an odd thing, but at the same time, you know, hands are these weird appendages. We don't quite know what to do with our hands. I mean, famously, we never know what to do with them in photographs.
And the sheer sadness of the man who has nothing to do. So he sits in his backyard watching a lizard catch flies. And he roots for the flies. And hours go by. And there's something so chilling to me because I'm thinking, you know, William Burroughs writes about like doing heroin so that he can stare at this big toe and find it fascinating. And I reluctantly must admit, I've probably whiled away a lifetime or two staring at like lizards and flies, you know, if not my big toe. West just captures these states of mind below the flash and the glitz of what he's describing and the high impact. There's a subtler humanity to it and these just very uncomfortable truths about who we are and how we are.
I find the boredom of Homer Simpson that you describe so well there in terms of watching the lizard and the flies to also be a boredom that captures everybody in this book. I mean, it's a very narcissistic and shallow world, but in fact, they're bored and decadent.
And what he's describing and capturing is one of the most horrific elements of life in Southern California. And the truly disturbing ubiquitous quality of the sunshine. It is just relentlessly sunny, and you're always supposed to be, by default, enjoying yourself because it's so sunny. And I've always found that, you know, as a guy who on many an occasion back in the proverbial day found himself staggering around at 6 a.m, it's like, oh God, not the sunlight again, you know? And it's just relentless. And Homer just is bathed in this soup of sunshine, and it's just destroying him to the point where he's attained a kind of zen that the rest of us can but hope for, sitting in his backyard, staring at the lizards and the flies.
And we have an excerpt from the audiobook of The Day of the Locust, in which the character Homer Simpson first meets the washed-up vaudeville actor Harry Greener, the father of the novel's siren, Faye Greener. Let's hear it.
He had been living this way for almost a month when one day, just as he was about to prepare his lunch, the doorbell rang. He opened it and found a man standing on the step with a sample case in one hand and a derby hat in the other. Homer hurriedly shut the door again. The bell continued to ring. He put his head out of the window nearest the door to order the fellow away, but the man bowed very politely and begged for a drink of water. Homer saw that he was old and tired and thought that he looked harmless. He got a bottle of water from the icebox, then opened the door and asked him in. "The name, sir, is Harry Greener," the man announced in sing-song, stressing every other syllable. Homer handed him a glass of water. He swallowed it quickly, then poured himself another. "Much obliged," he said with an elaborate bow. "That was indeed refreshing." Homer was astonished when he bowed again, did several quick jig steps, then let his derby hat roll down his arm. It fell to the floor. He stooped to retrieve it, straightening up with a jerk as though he had been kicked, then rubbed the seat of his trousers ruefully. Homer understood that this was to amuse, so he laughed. Harry thanked him by bowing again, but something went wrong. The exertion had been too much for him. His face blanched, and he fumbled with his collar. "A momentary indisposition," he murmured, wondering himself whether he was acting or sick. "Sit down," Homer said. But Harry wasn't through with his performance. He assumed a gallant smile and took a few unsteady steps toward the couch, then tripped himself. He examined the carpet indignantly, made believe he had found the object that had tripped him, and kicked it away. He then limped to the couch and sat down with a whistling sigh, like air escaping from a toy balloon.
That was Grover Gardner reading from Nathaniel West's The Day of the Locust, the book choice of my guest for this episode of Shelf Life, the writer Jerry Stahl, author of Permanent Midnight and 999. Jerry, when did you first read Day of the Locust? Do you remember?
Yes, I read it when I was about 18 years old, when I had first moved to New York City. I'd never been to Southern California. I knew nothing about this world. I never thought in a million years I would end up within miles of it. But I was an 18-year-old reading the quote-unquote, why do I keep saying quote-unquote? You know, does that happen to you when you write or speak, you suddenly, this phrase just pops up and you've never used it before or since, now you can't shut up and it keeps coming up? Anyway, I was reading Nabokov and Beckett and DeLillo and Flannery O'Connor and all these, what they used to be called, not in the racial sense, but in the darkly humorous sense, black humorous, back in the 70s. And West was included in that group. And he just grabbed me. I related to him so much. And, you know, even the fact that Nathaniel West, if you know anything about his, he was like, I think it was Nathaniel Brownstein, and he changed his name, but he used to manage a hotel in New York City, and it'd hang out with like Dashiell Hammett and all these other nut job luminaries. And what they would do is, of an evening, they'd get drunk and steam open the residence mail and read their letters out loud and pass them around and just laugh hysterically at these the most personal torments and tribulations of these utter strangers. And I thought, well, that is the real thing, man. You know, forget literature. He had some great source material.
It's funny you mentioned reading Beckett, because I see a lot of Waiting for Godot in this book, Day of the Locust. Homer Simpson, yeah, especially, just seems to sort of epitomize that, yeah, sense of, I don't know, the vacuousness and pointlessness of life.
The one Hollywood, I'm going to interrupt you because it's an obnoxious habit, and B, the one Hollywood book, straight up Hollywood book I ever wrote, and probably the most popular on the mainstream way, was I, Fatty, which is a faux memoir of Fatty Arbuckle, which I only mentioned because the opening quote of that book is from Beckett. He says, there is nothing funnier than unhappiness. And that pretty much says it all, particularly if you're Nathaniel West sitting behind the desk with a bunch of lunatics getting smashed on bourbon, reading other people's mail. And it's a devastating truth that Beckett has hit upon.
You said at the beginning of this conversation on Nathaniel West's Day of the Locust that you don't read it so much as a novel about Hollywood, but as a novel about MAGA and where we are today. But I wonder if you see any of contemporary Hollywood in West's description of Hollywood of the 1930s.
Absolutely. It is a place that exists so that other people can't get in. You know, they build the glass so that the quote unquote masses can press their nose against it and resent the fact that they can't get in. And you still see it. You know, they still have to close off the street for the premieres. It's frozen in amber. The difference is that now it's like all access all the time. So there's very few aspects of any star that haven't been invaded, if not degraded, by just sort of the nonstop, endless, all day, all night media spotlight.
You've said that you love writers who say the unsayable. Who are those writers?
I think Nathaniel West is the top of the list, Bruce J. Friedman, and Beckett himself. You know, I can't go on, I'll read Beckett. But I think the darkest writers are the truest writers. And This Way for the Gas, ladies and gentlemen, by yet another Holocaust survivor, I think it was Borofsky, even a title like that, you know, and to find humor, again, people are always looking for some sort of triumphant ascension in books that we read. And I think that really, the unsayable is the thing we all know inside us, and we see it, and we're taken aback, and don't want to hear it, don't want to read it, and can't stop reading.
Jerry Stahl, on that note, this has been a real pleasure.
All right, man, thank you.
We've been talking about 999, one man's tale of depression, psychic torment, and A Bus Tour of the Holocaust by Jerry Stahl, published by Akashic Books. And The Day of the Locust by Nathaniel West, published by New Directions. My thanks, as always, to my producer, Ilya Meretz, and the sound engineer and composer, Tim Wood. Shelf Life is a production of Grand Journal and One Grand Books in association with WJFF Radio Catskill. And if you like the show, you can find plenty more on Apple, Spotify, or on shelflifepodcast.net. With guests such as Alan Cumming, John Waters, Joyce Maynard, Melissa Gilbert, and Sir David Hare. While you're there, consider giving us a review or a 5-star rating. It will help others find us.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Jason Dole with the forecast. A winter weather advisory is in effect for our listening area until 10 o'clock tonight. A second wave of snow today may enter the region, possibly bringing an additional couple of inches of snow between late this afternoon and early tonight. Plan on slippery road conditions. After the snow, even colder air returns, overnight low of 12 tonight, with lows in the single digits the next two nights. This is Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR.
Sullivan County's social host law, Jared's Law, makes it illegal for anyone 18 or older to provide alcohol or cannabis to minors. Named for a local teen killed in a drunk driving accident, Jared's Law ensures that adults are held accountable, with penalties including fines and even jail time. Parents and guardians are still the number one deterrent to underage substance use, and Jared's Law